Imagine you've spent, I don't know, years meditating.
Oh, yeah, a really long time.
Right? You've been deeply reflecting, trying to see past your own ego, dealing with all the relentless noise in your
The
head.
constant chatter.
Exactly.
Right.
And then finally you hit it, a profound state of radiant, peaceful clarity.
Wow.
The noise just stops. You feel completely detached, pure, and present, and you think, I've made it. I have found enlightenment.
That's the dream, right?
Yeah, but what if that very peace you are feeling is actually a trap?
Oh,
What
man.
if it's just a stealthy, far more sophisticated cage for your ego?
I mean, it is arguably the ultimate cosmic joke played by our own cognition. You
Yeah.
think you finally escaped the maze, but you've actually just found a really comfortable, beautifully decorated room right in the dead center of it.
And you just lock the door behind you,
Exactly. You lock yourself right
which
in.
is exactly the kind of paradox we are getting into today. So, welcome to our deep dive on a truly mind-bending philosophical dialogue titled The Trap of Spiritual Reification.
It's a heavy one, but so good.
It really is. We are looking at this incredibly rich collection of philosophical texts that explore how human cognition constantly trips itself up.
Right.
We're going to examine how we mistake these temporary meditative experiences for permanent truths.
Yeah, we make them solid.
Exactly. And more importantly, we're going to look at how ancient frameworks like Anatta,
The concept of non-self.
right, Anatta, and the rigorous logic of a philosopher named Nagarjuna, how these things can basically shatter those illusions.
It's a fascinating journey, honestly, because it deals with the very mechanics of how we perceive reality on a moment-to-moment basis.
Totally.
The overarching mission for our deep dive today is to untangle this dense material for you. We're going to map the journey from what the sources call standard awareness teachings.
Which actually leave you stuck, right?
Yeah, they leave you stuck in this illusion of a background mind, and we'll map that all the way to a radical, completely centerless way of experiencing reality.
And look, whether you are actively studying philosophy or, exploring mindfulness on your own, or you just love a good aha moment about how your own brain works,
Which we all do.
right, this deep dive is going to completely reframe how you experience your own thoughts.
Absolutely.
So let's get right into the first major pitfall. Practitioners often reach this state of luminous clarity,
Yeah, they describe it as a feeling of I-amness.
or sometimes it's called aye-aye. It's this beautiful, still radiance, but then almost instinctively, we ruin it.
We can't help
We
ourselves.
really can't. Because our minds default to a dualistic framework, we immediately try to turn this dynamic, seamless experience into a thing.
A noun.
Right. We try to make an eternal witness or an ultimate background or an unchanging mirror. Okay, let's unpack it. Think of it this way.
Okay.
It's like you're wandering through a dense forest, right? And you stumble upon this beautifully pristine natural clearing.
Just perfectly peaceful.
Perfectly peaceful. But instead of just standing there and experiencing the clearing, your brain immediately paves it over with concrete.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it paves it over to build a massive observation tower, just so it has a secure place to stand and watch the forest.
What's fascinating here is the silent sleight of hand the ego performs to build that tower.
Sleight of hand, yeah.
Because the ego doesn't actually die in that moment of profound meditation. It just migrates.
It moves.
Exactly. It moves from being the active doer, the gross ego caught up in the daily drama of your life, your job, your anxieties,
Narcissus.
right, the messy stuff. It moves from that to becoming the passive observer, the spiritual ego.
Oh.
You convince yourself you've realized the ultimate truth because you are no longer identifying with your messy thoughts. You tell yourself, I am not my anger, I am the watcher of my anger.
Right, the witness.
But all you've done is consolidated your sense of I into a luminous witness. You've created what the material calls the mirage of the mirror.
The mirage of the mirror. That metaphor really stuck out to me in the reading.
It's a big one.
It's this incredibly common idea in spiritual circles that consciousness is like a pristine static mirror. And all our human experiences, the pain, the joy, the
Someone's
boredom,
reflections.
right, just reflections passing across it. And we tell ourselves the mirror itself is never actually stained by the reflections. We try to live as the untouched mirror.
Which sounds incredibly peaceful, right? Until you look at the actual mechanics of it.
Yeah.
That is precisely the fallacy of the background mind or the container mind theory.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, the error is that it implies a severe dualism. It suggests that the mirror, the silent witness, is somehow more real or more pure than the reflections themselves.
Ah, I see.
It creates a hierarchy where everyday life is just an illusion passing by and only the background is truth.
Right.
But there is no static background mirror separate from the reflections. There is only the ongoing active process of reflecting.
Just the process itself.
Exactly. The very moment you posit a background that stays the same while the foreground changes, you have just reestablished a permanent self. You've separated yourself from reality again.
So if building that observation tower in the clearing just traps us in a new kind of ego, why is it our default move? Like, why can't we just leave the clearing alone?
It's a great question.
The material argues it's because the very tools and questions we use to explore our consciousness are rigged from the start.
Completely rigged.
We are essentially set up to fail by the architecture of the questions we ask. Take the famous meditative koan, who am I?
Right, a classic.
Human language is completely subject-predicate-based. When you ask who, your brain is already primed to find a noun.
It needs an object.
Yeah, it is hunting for a thing, a soul, a definitive witness.
The structure of the inquiry entirely dictates the result. The word who presupposes that a subject exists before the journey even begins.
Oh, that's wild.
You aren't asking if there is a self. You are asking what the self is. So the brain goes looking for an object to satisfy the grammar of the question.
Now, I have to push back here on behalf of anyone who has ever read basic Eastern philosophy, because I had this exact reaction.
Go for it.
Isn't asking who am I the absolute classic ultimate spiritual question?
Oh, it's everywhere.
Yeah. The material even brings up the meti-neti practice. Not this process of elimination.
Right.
You sit down and ask, am I my hand? No. Am I my memories? No. Am I my changing emotions? No. Doesn't stripping away those superficial layers logically reveal the pure, unvarnished truth underneath?
It seems perfectly logical, I grant you that, but it falls into what is known as the reductive trap.
The reductive trap.
Think of it like peeling an onion. When you strip away the layers, the body, the memories, the passing thoughts, you are subconsciously expecting to find a solid gold nugget of truth waiting at the absolute center.
You want that core identity.
Exactly. But an onion is just layers. There is no pit. When a practitioner does this, not this, not this elimination, what they actually find at the end is stillness.
Just quiet.
Yeah. The mind has simply settled down because they've stopped attaching to thoughts.
But they don't interpret it as just a settled mind, do they?
Yeah.
They interpret it as finding the nugget.
That's the trap. The brain mistakenly encapsulates that localized, temporary taste of stillness and slaps a label on it. It says, permanent ultimate substance.
Oh, man.
It takes experience, a verb, and turns it into an entity, a noun. Because your method of inquiry was a process of elimination looking for a core, you forced the resulting stillness to become that core. You reified it.
Reification.
Yeah. To reify means to make a concrete thing out of something that isn't a thing.
So by searching for a noun in a universe that is entirely made of verbs, we are forcing an unnatural result. We are basically trying to grab a handful of river water and call it a solid rock.
That's a perfect way to put it. And if that luminous clarity isn't recognized as being completely empty of any inherent permanent essence, it just becomes a high-level conceptual resting place.
A hiding spot.
Exactly. That is how a practitioner ends up stuck. It becomes a fragile state you feel you have to desperately protect from the noise of the outside world rather than recognizing the actual nature of reality.
But if our language is rigged, and our concept of the witness is just a subtle cage, what is the solvent? How do we dissolve that noun?
We need something strong.
Right. The sources introduce the insight of anatta, or non-self, to vigorously cleanse this luminous clarity. This is how we transition from a noun-based reality to a verb-based reality.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, anatta is the surgical strike that collapses the entire background mind fallacy.
Okay, how so?
It's often translated simply as no soul, but it's much more radical than that. It's the realization that in the scene, there is only the scene. In a moment of hearing, there is just the hearing.
Just the verb.
Right. Let's break down the grammar of how we normally experience things. We think there is a sound over there and a hearing process in the middle and a mind that hears sitting in the background.
Like three separate things.
Exactly. Anatta collapses those three things into one event. There is no background recipient of the sound.
So the radiance of the experience has no source and no recipient. It's just the experience itself happening.
Yes.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The material talks about applying this to all six streams of consciousness.
Ah.
That means visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental phenomena. It introduces this concept of instant presencing.
Which is huge.
It really is, because it completely destroys the hierarchy that says meditating in a quiet room is somehow superior to walking down a noisy street.
Right, because everything is the stream.
Exactly. If luminosity is the nature of all six streams, it means the screeching sound of a passing car or like a sudden anxious thought is just as luminous and empty as the deepest meditative stillness.
Because the temporal trap of an internal witness, you know, someone waiting out the storm of life for a quiet moment, is completely removed.
It's gone.
The presence is the experience. When that screeching car sound arises, that specific hearing presencing arises with it. And when the sound stops, that specific presencing is gone.
It doesn't stick around.
No. There isn't some hearingless presence just hanging around in the background waiting for the next sound to arrive. The presencing and the appearance arise and cease together instantly.
Which means there's absolutely no need to maintain some special, fragile spiritual state.
Thank goodness.
Right. You don't have to walk around like you're balancing a glass of water on your head, terrified of losing your I am-ness if someone cuts you off in traffic.
Such a relief.
It is. The vividness of whatever is happening right now, even if it's chaotic.
Yes, the clarity. It is total functional presence. In the traditional ego stage, you think you are your body and your personal drama.
Yeah.
In the awareness stage, you find the light inside your subjective center and become the untouched witness. But in the anatta stage, you realize the light is the sound, the color, the taste, the thought.
There's no separation.
None. There is no inside or outside anymore. The world and the mind become a single, centerless, radiant flow.
Okay, I follow the logic all the way through that flow. But I have to admit, when I hit the final section of our sources, I got completely lost.
It gets really dense.
It does. Mm-hmm. The text introduces a final, incredibly stubborn layer of what it calls cognitive obscurance. And to break through it, we apparently need a philosophical wrecking ball.
The ultimate wrecking ball.
Enter the ancient Indian philosopher Nagarjuna and his foundational text, the MMK.
You aren't alone in getting lost there. Nagarjuna's work is famously deliberately perplexing.
Okay, glad it's not just me.
Oh, definitely not. When the analytical mind encounters his logic, it essentially short circuits. But that confusion isn't a failure of your intelligence.
No.
No, it's actually the sound of your dualistic machinery grinding to a halt. Nagarjuna targets what the text calls a half-boiled realization.
Right, the half-boiled realization.
Right.
This is where a practitioner accepts that the self is empty, and they even accept that the witness is empty.
They've done the anatta work.
Yeah, but they secretly treat the conditions that bring about these states as solid foundational realities.
Exactly.
So I might say, okay, my ego is an illusion, but my meditation method is completely real. The laws of cause and effect are real. The physical brain is real. We keep one foot planted in a substantial solid world while claiming to be empty.
This raises an important question. If the result of a process, say the luminous clarity you achieve from meditating, if that is empty and has no inherent essence, how can the cause or the condition that produced it be real?
Well, right.
Nagarjuna uses rigorous dialectic logic to systematically dismantle this. He uses a tool called the tetralemma, which explores the four possible corners of any logical proposition.
And those are?
Something is, it is not, it both is and is not, or it neither is nor is not.
Okay, let's walk through that, because saying it both is and is not usually just sounds like riddles to me.
Uh-huh.
How does he use the tetralemma to dismantle cause and effect?
Let's use the classic example of a seed producing a sprout.
Okay, simple enough.
What? We normally think a solid, real seed causes a real sprout. Nagarjuna asks, does the sprout come from itself? No, a seed is not a sprout.
Right.
Does the sprout come from something other than itself? Well, if totally separate others can cause things, why doesn't a rock produce a sprout?
Okay, fair point.
Does it come from both? That's a logical contradiction. Does it come from neither? That implies magic, things just popping into existence for no reason.
So he eliminates every possible way we logically explain cause and effect. But, I mean, we see seeds turning into sprouts every day. So what is he actually proving?
He is proving that you cannot have a completely real, solid, independent entity undergo change.
Oh.
If a seed had permanent seedness inherently inside it, it could never change into a sprout. It would just be a seed forever.
That makes sense.
Change requires emptiness. The seed only exists in relation to the soil, the water, the sun, and the observer. Neither the condition of the seed nor the effect of the sprout exists on its own side.
They don't have independent reality.
They don't. They are purely 100% dependently arisen.
They only exist in interaction. And this is where the material brings in an analogy that suddenly made it click for me.
The physics one.
Yes. To explain how ancient philosophy maps to reality, they compare Nagarjuna's logic to Carlo Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics.
It's a brilliant comparison.
It really is. For anyone unfamiliar, in standard physics, we think of objects as having definite properties, like a ball has a specific speed and location.
Right, it's a solid thing doing the thing.
Exactly. But in Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics, particles literally do not have properties like speed or position until they interact with something else, like a detector or another atom.
Before that, they're just probabilities.
Right. Before that interaction, they're just probabilities. They don't have a solo, independent existence.
The properties only exist as the relationship. It's a profound way to look at existence. Nagarjuna doesn't just dismantle the I, he dismantles the very laws of reality we try to lean on for comfort.
And the sources refer to this as living in a non-substantialist digital garden.
I love that term.
Me too. Because when we hear garden, we think of a plot of dirt with physical plants. But a digital garden, like a wiki or a hyperlink notebook, is an ecosystem of pure relations.
Yeah.
A page in a digital garden only has meaning because of the pages linking to it and the pages it links out to. There is no original solid page that exists independently of the network.
Not at all.
The meditation method, the brain, the practitioner, the causes, they aren't solid foundations. They're all just part of what the material beautifully calls the grammar of illusion.
The grammar of illusion, because condition can only be called a condition if it produces an effect.
Right.
If it hasn't produced an effect yet, it isn't a condition. If the effect already exists, the condition is no longer needed. They lean on each other like two playing cards forming a triangle.
Remove one and the other falls.
Exactly. So if the result is empty, the cause must be empty. It is a seamless, centerless web of relations without a solid floor anywhere.
So to truly cleanse ourselves from the trap of reification, we have to realize that the meditative stillness we seek isn't just an empty result. It's an enactment with no solid foundation whatsoever.
Yeah.
The breathing technique, the mindfulness practice itself, is just as empty as the result.
Yeah.
And while that sounds, honestly, absolutely terrifying at first.
Like losing the ground beneath your feet?
Yeah, falling forever. But the argument is that it's actually the ultimate freedom.
Because it completely exhausts the analytical mind's ability to create things to hold on to. The problem of all problems is our thirst for a permanent anchor in a universe of flow.
We just want something solid.
We do. And Nagarjuna's cryptic logic is the medicine that cures that specific thirst. Once you dismantle the conditions, you aren't left with a dark void of nothingness.
You aren't.
No, you are left with an incredibly vibrant, dynamic reality that doesn't need you to hold it together.
Which brings us to the end of this massive cognitive journey. Let's recap how far we've traveled.
It's been quite a trip.
It really has. We started with the everyday gross ego, the messy daily identity trying to survive. Then we saw how practitioners transition into the refined, but ultimately trapped, I or luminous witness state.
The background mind.
The observation tower in the clearing. From there, we passed through the solvent of anatta, non-self, to strip away the center entirely, realizing that the observer is just as empty as the observed.
The hearing is just the hearing.
Right. And finally, with Nagarjuna's wrecking ball, we landed in total non-substantialist freedom, where even the seemingly solid laws of cause and effect are seen as a centerless quantum web of relations.
It's a total paradigm shift. You move from a reality built on solid substances to a reality of pure functional presence.
Yeah.
The Buddhist phrasing is that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. They aren't two different places.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this, trying to navigate your daily life?
It's a big question.
It means that true awakening isn't some fragile static state that you have to stubbornly maintain.
Mm.
You don't have to retreat to a cave or a silent room to find a background mind that watches everything in perfect peace while detaching from your real life.
You don't have to hide.
No. The vividness of your current reality, the noise of traffic, the color of your coffee cup, the stress of a deadline, the joy of a conversation, that is the clarity.
Exactly.
The radiance isn't hiding inside a quiet, empty mind. The radiance is the emptiness, appearing brilliantly right in front of you as the world.
It forces us to completely let go of the need for an anchor. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
What is hearing?
The very next time you hear a sharp sound, maybe a siren outside or a dog barking, or you see a remarkably vibrant color, what if you stop trying to be the listener or the watcher standing apart from it?
Just be it.
Yeah. If you are the seeing and the hearing itself with no background mirror to anchor you, what exactly happens to the boundaries of you the moment that sound stops?